Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
You can find plenty to debate in the Trump administration's budget proposal for 2018. At the top of the list is that 10% increase in defense spending. For what it would buy and what strategies might animate it, we turn to Todd Harrison, Director of Defense Budget Analysis at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Todd, good to have you back.
Yeah, good to be here.
I guess maybe it's useful to look at the budget proposal for 2018 and that $600 and whatever billion it is in context with the supplemental request for 2017, because they seem to be almost complementary.
That's right. And that's probably the bigger news, actually, the supplemental request for 2017, because the administration had already previewed what was going to be in the 2018 budget request. And all they actually released was a top line number of $603 billion for the total national defense budget. So that includes nuclear funding and Department of Energy and a few other agencies that do defense-related work, plus an additional $65 billion in overseas contingency operations funding. But there's no detail on how they're going to spend the 2018 money. We'll have to wait until the full budget request comes out, probably sometime in late May, before we get those details. But what we did get is in the 2017 supplemental request, it's a total of $30 billion they're asking for defense. And they gave us a lot of detail and where that money would go. So I think, you know, that is really the more interesting thing that's come out this week.
And of that $30 billion, only $5 billion, I guess, was for the OCO, which means they're really looking to boost defense spending right now in the base. And I guess you have to appreciate their honesty in putting it there instead of the OCO.
Yes. I mean, that's that was one of the surprises in the request, is that, $5 billion in OCO funding and $25 billion in the base budget. The reason it's a surprise is that means you have to change the budget caps for the base defense budget. If you put it in OCO, it doesn't count towards your budget caps. But when you put it in the base budget, it does count. And the base budget is already capped for 2017 at $551 billion. And so they want to add another $25 billion on top of that. So what that means is that Congress has to change the budget cap levels. To change the budget caps, though, you can't do that with a simple majority. You actually have to get 60 votes in the Senate. So this is going to make it more difficult to get it through Congress.
What do you think John McCain might react to this? I know that he has said that the 2018 request is still way below what he would like to see, even though it's above what the Obama administration was asking for earlier. But on this year's piece, the 2017 supplemental, what do you think a McCain would do there?
Yeah, I mean, I think initial reactions are that the defense hawks like McCain and Thornberry in Congress are pretty happy with the supplemental request for 2017. You know, looking at the total dollar amount, that is about what they were pushing for. I mean, I'm sure they would have always been happy with even more. But $30 billion is about as much as anyone expected to get in an FY17 supplemental. But you know, at the end of the day, it's not really up to the defense hawks in Congress. You know, to get 60 votes in the Senate, they got to keep all 52 Republicans, and there are some fiscal hawks within that crowd that aren't entirely pleased with this proposal. And they got to bring on 8 Democrats to get the 60 votes. The other complicating factor in all of this is something we haven't brought up yet. It's what's going on the non-defense side of the budget. So for the FY17 supplemental request, while they're asking for, you know, another $25 billion in base budget funding for defense and $5 billion in OCO, it also calls for $18 billion in cuts to the non-defense side of the budget, and then $3 billion in new funding to fund the border wall and implementation of other executive orders. Those are pretty controversial positions for the Trump administration, and so I think that actually makes it less likely that this proposal will make it through Congress intact.
We're speaking with Todd Harrison, Director of Defense Budget Analysis at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I guess the one thing we don't have anymore are really two things. One is earmarks to kind of horse trade over, and the other is people like Scoop Jackson.
Yeah, and you know, we know how these budget deals have worked for the past 5 years since we've had the Budget Control Act. Budget deals have worked the same way every time. For every dollar increase in defense, there's been a dollar increase in non-defense. So there's been this parity between defense and non-defense. Now, that was possible because you had, you know, a Democrat in the White House. And even though Republicans have majorities in both chambers of Congress, you know, they still had to get past the president's veto pen. You know, I think a lot of people who were, you know, defense hawks were optimistic that they could break that parity principle now that they've got a Republican in the White House, but they have slimmer majorities in the House and the Senate. And you still got the 60-vote threshold in the Senate. So Democrats still have quite a bit of power here. And, you know, if I had to bet at this point in the game, I would bet that the budget deal we end up with for 2017 is probably going to look more like what we've had in the past. It'll be some increase for defense, probably smaller than is being proposed right now, and probably some increase in non-defense. I think that's the only way they're going to get this through.
Looking at the 2017 supplemental as it came out, what does it buy and what does it say their priorities are for defense this year?
Yeah, so you know, if you look at the details of it, about half of the supplemental request is going to procurement. So buying lots of new equipment, more fighter jets, more munitions, basically trying to, you know, purchase a lot of things that were on the services wish list from this past year, things that didn't make it into the original budget request because there just wasn't enough funding available. And these are things that, quite frankly, Congress was already chomping at the bit to fund. So, you know, not a lot of surprises in there. But the other additions that we see in the budget, about $7 billion in additional base budget funding going into operation and maintenance, and about $1 billion going into military personnel accounts. And that's to basically help restore some of the readiness that's been degraded over the past few years and bring force levels up to a higher level, especially for the Army in strength. They're going to be adding several thousand more troops than had previously been planned in the budget. I think they're adding about 15, 16,000 above what was previously planned. The Air Force is bringing their in-strength back up. So is the Navy. So is the Marine Corps. So a lot of it is kind of bringing those force levels back up to where the services wanted to be, but, you know, were constrained by the previous budget level.
Now, when you bring those people back, it does have a long life cycle cost tail to it. Because
it does. And so that's one of the things I've tried to warn people about in this, you know, buildup of the budget is be careful how you grow, especially if you don't have a long-term budget deal and you can't be assured of, you know, you're going to have continued growth in future years. You should think carefully about adding force structure and increasing in strength right now, because that just means you're going to have more mouths to feed in the future. And if you're already starving unit, adding more is just going to mean more starving mouths in the future.
It's almost the parallel of states that have this big Medicaid overhang becomes a bigger and bigger portion of their budgets that they're obligated to pay, and there's less for what they'd like to have currently.
And it effectively, you know, in the military, adding force structure may help in the near term, but it ties your hands in the long run. And so it can ultimately mean that you don't have as much money or as much flexibility to invest in future capabilities. And so, you know, the types of capabilities you might need 5 or 10 years from now, you may not be able to afford because of the force structure you're adding today.
Todd Harrison is Director of Defense Budget Analysis and Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. As always, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Find a link to more of his thinking and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Trump administration has shown a clear preference for boosting defense funding. And at least in the case of the Navy, there are already some detailed blueprints in the national security policy community about how that extra money should be spent. One of them comes from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, which is just out with a new report called Restoring American Sea Power. Beyond arguing for a larger fleet, the authors say the Navy needs to be re-architected, since it's not currently structured to meet the threats it's likely to face in the coming decades. Brian Clark is a senior fellow at CSBA. He talked with Jared Serbu about what the reimagined fleet would look like.
The strategic landscape that we are looking at is in the 2030s. So the tasking from Congress for this study was to look in the 2030 timeframe and evaluate what the security challenges are likely to be and determine what our fleet might need to look like to address those challenges. So it's a different set of concerns than we have today. The two things that we think are going to be significant changes between now and then are, one, China and Russia are going to be much more capable than they are today. So even though Russia is a small military power, unnecessarily, but it has a high capability military force, it'll be even more capable in this time frame. China clearly has a rather large military and is growing it, and it will, in addition, be more capable in the 2030s. So both of them will have the ability to pursue the kinds of aggression that they've been trying to assert themselves into in their near abroad over the last couple of years. The second thing is we're going to face a continued challenge from terrorism and insurgency like we have, but with more capable weapons and more capable methods of disseminating information. So those two big trends are going to drive the way the Navy needs to develop.
And so then describe the basic concepts behind the deterrence force and the maneuver force that you talk about in the study. How do those differ from the ways in which the Navy thinks about deploying and rotating units now?
Sure. The way the Navy deploys today is kind of that post-Cold War construct where we didn't really have a pure competitor. The United States was able to pretty much beat anybody that it faced in a military fight. And as a result, it just needed to have enough military forces deployed overseas to demonstrate our resolve, to show that we mean business and that the forces that we maintain overseas will be the leading edge of an eventual U.S. response. And that kept most countries like Iran, China, to some degree Russia, North Korea, in line because they saw that, well, this may not be the force that's going to beat me that's out here. This force is sufficient for me to get the U.S. involved, and eventually they're going to win because they are a predominant military power. That's not going to be the case here in the 2030s. We're going to have to face competitors that could beat us in some situations close to home, especially when it comes to their forces. So we felt like the force that we deploy today, which is mostly carrier strike groups deployed overseas as the main unit of issue of U.S. naval power, aren't really well suited for that. Because what happens is those carrier strike groups can be suppressed for some short period of time by large numbers of missile attacks. And what happens is, because the kinds of objectives that a China or a Russia has in this time period are going to be things that are relatively close to their country, so think about Taiwan for China or maybe the Baltic states for Russia, they could get those countries or get those objectives within a few days or maybe a week. And they can suppress a carrier strike group during that time frame so that it's not able to generate a lot of combat sorties and not unable to launch aircraft. So you're left with a force that's unable to really impact a warfight in the time frame it would need to make a difference. So we've shifted to instead split up the Navy that's deployed overseas to include a deterrence force, which is largely missile-based forces, so surface ships and submarines, and they stay up forward, and they're able to generate a large number of fires in a short period of time on short notice. So if a warfight occurs, if an aggression occurs from China trying to attack Taiwan or Russia trying to attack the Baltics, these forces can attack those forces very rapidly with missiles for a short period of time. And then they run out of missiles. Then they're backed up by what we call the maneuver force. And the maneuver force is where those carrier strike groups go. And they spend most of their time somewhat offshore where they can't necessarily be suppressed early on, but then they can come in after the fight has started and back up the deterrence forces and be able to do what they do best, which is sustain combat power over a really long period of time. So an adversary is faced with this very high-volume missile-based set of fires early on that turns into carrier airstrikes that'll continue for however long they need to continue. So it's a much more formidable opponent that the China or Russia or Iran would face than they do today, and more suited to what those two different forces do.
So if the Navy were to make this kind of transition, what would it need to change in terms of platforms? I mean, how much of this can you achieve with ships that are already in the inventory? To what extent do you need to buy more of the same or entirely different kinds of assets?
So we built a shipbuilding plan to accompany the fleet architecture that started with today's fleet. So we would use all of the things in today's fleet going forward. And then we would evolve the fleet over time into the 2030s by not buying some ships anymore, and then buying new ships in some numbers, and then buying more of today's ships in some numbers. So the ones we buy more of that we have today are submarines. So the Virginia-class submarines, we would buy more of those to get up to an eventual number of 66, which is 12 or 13 more than today. We would buy fewer destroyers than the Navy already has, and then we would buy more smaller surface combatants. So we'd buy more LCSs or frigates going forward, and we'd buy a new class of smaller surface vessel, which is like a corvette that's similar to what a lot of other nations have. So we'd buy surface forces that are maybe more numerous, but geared towards a smaller set of ships than the large combatants that we have today. We'd buy pretty much the same number of amphibious warships and then repurpose some of them to be carrying mostly fixed-wing aircraft instead of helicopters and MB-22s. We'd buy a little bit different mix of logistics ships than we have today, but we'd repurpose all the existing ones to try to use them in new ways, using new operating concepts. And we would use some different support vessels in the future, but we would repurpose the ones we have today, like the joint high-speed vessel and the float forward staging base. We'd use those into the future, but then we would replace them with more purpose-built ships for the types of operations our fleet is expected to do. So it keeps a lot of what today's fleet has, adds a little bit more in some categories, and then adds a couple of new categories of ships.
In terms of overall number, I think you're pushing toward 340 using the current counting rules compared to, I think,
right,
it's 275 today. What does that do to maintenance requirements? I mean, not only are you going to have a larger fleet, it sounds like you're going to be running some of these vessels pretty hard. So is there enough throughput in the shipyard industrial base, public and private, to accommodate everything you want to do with this fleet?
We did an analysis of the industrial base. That's a great question. And so we looked at the public industrial base, the public shipyards work on nuclear-powered ships today. So all of our public shipyards, all they work on are aircraft carriers and submarines. And those shipyards would need to be expanded a little bit to accommodate the fleet that we anticipate, mostly to accommodate changes in carrier home porting. We anticipate more carriers to be based on the West Coast, and there would need to be probably an additional dry dock on the West Coast to accommodate that. Then in the private private shipyards for maintenance, that's where we do all the maintenance on our surface combatants and our amphibious ships and our support vessels. And the analysis we did indicated that the private shipyard industrial base would be able to accommodate that, but it would need to be more workers within the existing infrastructure, and they need to be more flexible in order to accommodate the fact that, like you said, the ships are going to be operating in a higher operational tempo, so coming in more frequently for maintenance and maybe having less time for each individual maintenance availability. So that means that when they come into the shipyard's going to have to be able to hit the ground running, get the work done, and then send the ship back out. And if that means that some work has to be deferred to the next availability, then that may be how they have to operate. So breaking up long, year or 2 year long refits into 6 month chunks might be something that we're going to have to do in the future.
Brian Clark is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. We'll post a link to the report we've been talking about, Restoring American Sea Power, at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.